Welcome. Is everyone back? Okay, I'm assuming everyone's back. So let's keep going. Now we're going to talk about nervous system tools and the dance of expansion and contraction. Man, I really hope I'm not getting what David has. So, as you might imagine, I work with a lot of people who are in chronic states of varying from dysregulation to hypo or hyperarousal. When people have wide windows of tolerance, they don't work with someone like me. People who work with me are people with small windows of tolerance, usually. And since nervous system information, lingo, and tools are really trendy right now, people often come into my world wanting nervous system regulating tools. They want to know, what tools do I need to regulate myself and feel better? I just need nervous system tools and then I'll be fine. That's what's the missing thing from my life. But as you know, this is a part of feel without fear. So if you aren't feeling it, you aren't healing it. And what we feel or are afraid of feeling is what is outside our windows of tolerance. If you're afraid of anger, if you judge anger, that's why it's outside your window of tolerance. If you're afraid of shame or you judge shame or you think it's bad, that's why it's outside your window of tolerance. Nervous system regulating tools are the least useful to you when you use them to bypass or avoid the body's sensations, feelings, and symptoms. The least useful to you. Nervous system work is not about the tools. Nervous system work is not even about regulation, believe it or not. It is about being in our bodies, being present with whatever is happening. Nervous system work is meant to reconnect us to our bodies, to sensation, to emotion, to feelings that we have avoided for years because they're scary or uncomfortable or because our culture pathologizes them and labels them as bad. Yes, self-soothing is an important skill. Everyone needs to know how to self-soothe, but often, too often, our work stops once we've found the thing that works. The thing that makes us feel other than how we presently feel, especially if what's actually happening is uncomfortable and a feeling that we would rather avoid. Nervous system tools are really good at helping you avoid your feelings. Really, they are. If you always reach for a nervous system tool when you're feeling discomfort, you might be getting through that moment of dysregulation, but you are not expanding your window of tolerance to hold discomfort or stress. You're just getting through that moment or that period of dysregulation without having expanded your ability to hold that discomfort. So, the work of healing trauma, of healing the nervous system, of widening our windows of tolerance requires being able to feel uncomfortable things such as pain, anxiety, fear, abandonment, shame, rage, anger, etc. We have to be able to feel all of those things because all of them are very natural and normal human feelings. None of them are bad. This work definitely does not require us to be totally miserable and uncomfortable all the time. As we know from our last workshop, pleasure and play are huge parts of healing as well. So don't get into the narrative of like, shit, now I have to be uncomfortable and cry and feel all these horrible things all the time. And that's the only way I'm expanding. No, you need to be able to expand to hold the discomfort. But guess what? You also need to be able to expand to hold the joy and the pleasure and the play, because those things are often uncomfortable for us too. So, if we're using our nervous system tools as a means of avoiding discomfort, that is when expansion stops. I'm not telling you to stop using your nervous system tools, but I would like you to add a step in your process. I'll invite you to add a step to your process. Before you reach for your nervous system tool, whatever it is, breath work, stretching, crawling on the floor, shaking, whatever it is, tapping, whatever it is that you do, whatever your preferred nervous system tools are, before you reach for it, pause and feel first. That's all I'm asking you to do. Even if it's only for 30 seconds, then at least you've given yourself 30 seconds of exposure to that uncomfortable feeling before you regulate it away with a tool. Just pause and feel first. If you find it difficult or even impossible to be present with your feelings And you need nervous system tools frequently to get through the day. Your window of tolerance is small. You probably already know that. You will actually benefit more from widening your window of tolerance than you will from using nervous system tools to stay in a small window. Okay. Something that I'm really, really big on in my work is relief is great, but resolution is fantastic. Okay. Nervous system tools give relief. They don't resolve anything. Okay. So you will benefit more from letting yourself be exposed to that uncomfortable feeling, from pausing and feeling, than you will from avoiding it by using your tools, because then your window of tolerance always stays small. So remember when I said this, the line between dysregulation and hyper or hypoarousal is a blurry one and different from person to person. That's what we're going to dive into next. I cannot give you a prescriptive, here's when you're dysregulated, here's when you're hyper or hypoaroused, here's when you use a tool, here's when you don't. It's not my business to tell you any of those things. You are going to have to commit to the process of feeling and figuring all of that out on your own. Only you can know what you can handle and when you need a tool. Only you can decide that. No one else can decide that for you. This is part of your sovereignty. This is also why comparing what you can or can't tolerate to other people or to past versions of yourself is also not going to serve you very well. Because then it's based in judgment. So there is no prescriptive, there's no black and white lines, there's no neat little boxes. If you really like all of that, that doesn't exist. If you have resistance to that, notice it. Your resistance is allowed, but that doesn't change the fact that there is no prescriptive black and white check boxes for these things, because it's going to be different for your body and even for like the day of the month, you know, it's going to be different for you. But I can recommend when it might be necessary to use a tool and when you can stretch yourself to expand to be with discomfort. So I can make some recommendations. Again, you are a sovereign being. I trust you to take these recommendations and do with them whatever feels right for you. So back to our little box. If you are hyper or hypoaroused, you definitely probably need a tool. This is when your breath work, you're tapping, you're shaking, you're, you know, going for a run or a walk, being in nature, like whatever your tools are, that's when it's really going to serve you, is when you're hyper or hypoaroused. I would specifically recommend a nervous system CPR tool, because when you're hyper or hypoaroused, that's when you're having what I call an oh shit nervous system moment. So that's why I created nervous system CPR, and all of you have or should have access to that. Please let us know if you don't. But you should have access to nervous system CPR. So this is a collection of 9 short videos that are small file sizes. You can download them to your phone and you can literally have me in your pocket to walk you through an oh shit nervous system moment. Okay. I teach 9 different nervous system tools that are really, really effective at taking a hyper or hypoaroused nervous system and either mobilizing or bringing it way down. The goal for the nervous system CPR tool is at least to get you here. Better to get you here, but I at least want to get you here, because at least if you're dysregulated, you can still be present with discomfort. So if you are dysregulated, pause, sit with it, feel it. You may not need a tool. It might resolve all on its own. Many of you in these calls and in our group coaching calls, when I've worked with you individually, many of you have had the experience of noticing a really uncomfortable thing in your body, holding space for it and staying with it. And you notice that the volume on it goes down naturally. Many of you have had that experience already. So you didn't need a tool. You were just present with it and it naturally resolved or reduced on its own, which is great. So you don't always need a tool when you're dysregulated. You'll benefit from pausing and sitting with that feeling before reaching for a tool. So back to Newton's third law, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. For every expansion, there is a contraction. So if you blow out your window of tolerance, the equal and opposite reaction is that it may shrink down even smaller afterwards. The contraction is proportional to the expansion. It's unnecessary to blow out your window of tolerance because you want to face or heal your triggers. It's unnecessary to force yourself to stay in a state of hypo or hypoarousal because you think you're expanding your window of tolerance. Small, slow, gentle titration and intentional exposure to stress over time gently widens that window. This is a much gentler, more loving way than forcing yourself to push through those hyper or hypo-aroused moments. Gentleness and consistent practice also makes any contraction less severe while still allowing you to expand in slow, sustainable ways. If you try too much healing before you're ready for it, you get that big expansion and then whack, the universe comes and spanks you. My friend Kirby calls it a cosmic spank. It's also necessary to have tools that can bring you back to safety and regulation quickly when you are blown out of your window of tolerance. That's what nervous system CPR is for. However, we do not want or need to regulate away every moment of dysregulation because if we do, we aren't widening our windows of tolerance. With time, practice, and consistency, you will eventually be able to tolerate stressors that were once intolerable to you, and you will know how to return to the safety of your comfort zone when you need to. Unless you decide, which you are allowed to do, nope, this thing is too much. I don't want to deal with this, like I did with non-monogamy. So here's an example of my window of tolerance. About 5 years ago. So this is like right before I attempted to kill myself, right before I went into the hospital. My window of tolerance was tiny, tiny, tiny. This was all I could really tolerate at that time. And all of this stuff was not tolerable to me. Okay. I was housebound, I was bedbound. I couldn't tolerate socializing, exercising, physical activities. I had to have a rigid schedule and routine. I couldn't tolerate any inconsistencies. I couldn't even drive at that time. It was really, really bad. And I tried to make a graphic that illustrates all the things that are now within my window of tolerance, but the font was too tiny and you wouldn't have been able to read it because so much is inside my window of tolerance now. Literally everything that is outside of this window of tolerance from 5 years ago is now inside of this window of tolerance. And I love routine, but I no longer have to have it all the time. I love, all these things to make me feel calm, but I don't need them all the time. I can stay up late, I can socialize, I can work, I can be on social media, I can handle an inconsistent routine, all of it because of the work that I've done. So it's really exciting that I was not able to make you a graphic to tell you everything I can tolerate now because the font was too tiny. Do I ever get outside my window of tolerance now? Yes, rarely, but yes, it's pretty uncommon. I do get triggered sometimes, but it is a lot more rare now than what it used to be. I have cultivated a really intimate relationship with my body. I have so much confidence in my ability to return to the safety that I've created in my body that I usually notice when I'm getting close to blowing out my window of tolerance. And then I take those steps to bring myself back to the edge or back to my comfort zone. And again, the only way that I was able to learn this was by sovereignly taking responsibility of myself, listening to my own body, feeling free to experiment with different things. Like it's okay to experiment with stuff. You don't always need someone else to tell you what to do. Your body's really smart. And if you listen to her, she can guide you in whatever you need. So the goal is not never get dysregulated. The goal is appropriate dysregulation. Because dysregulation itself isn't bad or wrong. It's not a sign of personal failure. It's not a sign of weakness. You're a human being. Dysregulation is normal and healthy to an appropriate threat. Actually, I want to pause here. This isn't part of the workshop, but I'm like feeling like I need to say it. So I'm going to stop sharing for a second so you can just see my face. A few months ago, you may have been following me on Instagram. If not, you can go back and see the post from there. But I was really, really fired up about some of the marketing that I was seeing of various things on social media, specifically related to the nervous system and trauma healing and somatic work. And I saw these creators that had these massive accounts who were selling these programs and things. And the way that they were selling these things to people really pissed me off. Like I felt a very righteous anger about it. Because they were taking these like normal human things and sharing them in videos or in posts or whatever in a way that pathologized normal human things, so that if they could hit the right button and make you be like, oh my gosh, I have everything on that checklist, then magically there they were in the caption offering you the answer. So I saw one reel that really pissed me off that said that if you have the urge to redecorate your home, that is a sign of nervous system dysregulation. And I was like, this person has like a million followers. So like, it's not small stuff. If you have the urge to redecorate your home, that's a sign that your nervous system is dysregulated. And lo and behold, guess what? Here's the thing. I'm offering it in my caption for $99. It's going to fix you. What was missing from that piece was fucking context, right? Like, sure, if you're avoiding your feelings through compulsively redecorating your house and like impulse buying and shopping and all of that, okay, maybe you do need this program. But what if you're redecorating your house because you got like a creative wave of inspiration and like you just really felt like painting a room a different color, or you felt like, you know, getting some new throw pillows for the couch? Like, do we need to pathologize that? Like, is that wrong? Like, if you're feeling the creative wiggles and that's how you get your wiggles out, like, I don't understand like why we're pathologizing this. And this account specifically does this about multiple things. They do it about like, is your ear ringing? Are you bed rotting? Like different things like that. And they provide absolutely no fucking context. So they pathologize these things without giving context. And people who are really dysregulated or hyper or hypo aroused are more likely to buy into that shit. Because then they're like, oh, if that's the thing that's going to make me feel better, then that's what I need. Right. And then I've seen people in the comments that are like, well, I did your first program and I still feel this way. What can you recommend? And she's like, oh, well, you just need part two. So it just constantly keeps people coming back for more. Look, I'm going to poke at all your pain buttons. And I'm going to make you feel really shitty about yourself. And I'm going to get you to check off all these symptoms that you have or all these behaviors that you have. And then suddenly I'm going to be your savior with like the fix that's going to help you out. And it's all missing context. So David put a link in the chat for a podcast episode that my dear friend Kat Lee and I recently did. And we talk about this very thing. So that's another thing you can listen to if you haven't listened to it yet. But we talk a lot about appropriate response to threat. And we talk a lot about the context of your dysregulation. So one thing that I share in there is that I was going through a pretty severe period of burnout starting in the fall of last year, like around September, October. And that burnout persisted for like 6, 7 months. And on these videos that I saw on Instagram, I could check off every single one of the boxes. Like my ears were ringing, my sleep was fucked up, I was bed rotting, like all these different things. Like, yep, I do that, I do that, I do that, I do that. Oh, you're burned out? Here, you need my this, right? But because I understand my body and because I trust the wisdom of my body, I'm not fooled by marketing like that. And so when I zoom out and I look at the context of the burnout that I was experiencing, we're looking at, I've graduated 2 homeschooled children in the last 4 years. I've built a business from scratch in the last 4 years. I didn't start taking social media breaks until this year. So I was posting constantly and consistently on social media. I was consistently coaching without breaks. I was taking on more clients than I needed to without breaks. I was doing all of these different things. And so when my body got fed up with all of those things and with not being properly nourished physically, emotionally, spiritually, nutritionally during that period, then the context of the burnout makes sense, right? It makes sense. My body put the brakes on for me because I wasn't putting the brakes on for myself. Is that pathological? Is that bad? Do I need a somatic exercise program to get me out of that burnout? Or would that somatic exercise program be overriding the wisdom of my body? This is the kind of shit I'm talking about. This is why context And recognizing your dysregulation and what it's responding to as an appropriate threat or not. And only you can decide what an appropriate threat is or what an appropriate response is. So anyway, I'm off my soapbox. I'm going to go back to sharing my screen and we're going to keep going with our slides. Okay. So here are some more realistic goals than I never want to get dysregulated. Okay. Do you have more flexibility in your nervous system? Meaning you get activated to an appropriate threat. And once the threat is resolved, your nervous system naturally comes back to safety. That's a realistic goal to have. It's also realistic to have the goal of having more capacity in your nervous system, that you can hold more stress without added dysregulation, and you can also hold more expansion, such as joy and risk and pleasure. That's realistic. It's realistic to want more resiliency, to want to bounce back more quickly after stressful events so that they don't wipe you out. Or if they do wipe you out, it's okay. There's nothing wrong with you if you get wiped out by a really stressful event. It is a realistic goal to have more awareness of your sensations so that you can discern when dysregulation is becoming hypo or hyperarousal. It's a realistic goal to have more awareness of the voice in your head and any ego stories that you may have about feelings or sensations. So big reactions. When we're outside of our windows of tolerance, we usually know because our reaction is often big. We have big anger, big urge to run away, big anxiety, big freeze, big shutdown, right? That's a sign that you're hyper or hypo aroused. So for those of you, people used to not join this program from the beginning. I used to let people come to different workshops. That's what this slide's for. I probably need to take this slide out because it's not relevant anymore. But I want to take us back to our second workshop. If you'll recall, it was called Untriggered. So we're going to review this brain stuff. So your amygdala here and your hippocampus here work together. And that's what declares threat, threat. They then tell the hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus sends a message down the brainstem, and that's what activates the nervous system to fight, flee, or immobilize. So amygdala to hippocampus to hypothalamus to nervous system is the response to stress and stimuli that happens in real time with any sort of trauma or with any sort of trigger, right? The exact same series of events happens when we're hypo or hyper aroused, exactly the same, because the brain does not know the difference between a trauma that's happening in real time and a big trigger. And a trigger is a present moment resurrection of past trauma. So when hyper aroused, the limbic brain has sensed a threat level that can plunge us into undesirable behaviors like lashing out in anger, self-medicating with substances, withdrawing from life. So using words like affirmations and mantras don't work on the limbic brain. Your limbic brain does not speak English, Chinese, French, Spanish, light language, none of it, okay? Your limbic brain does not speak those languages. Your limbic brain also isn't keeping linear time. That's why it's as if it's happening in the moment, even though it's not. So when a threat, whether it's real or perceived, whether it's in the past or in the present moment, is detected, it takes only 75 milliseconds for the amygdala and the limbic brain to send survival signals throughout the body. So this is about 4 times faster than you can blink your eye. However, the prefrontal cortex, the part of our brain that allows us to reason, analyze, and make grounded thought out decisions, takes at least 350 milliseconds to perceive and evaluate the threat if the limbic brain hasn't totally taken over. Okay, so it takes 4 times longer for the prefrontal cortex to reason and analyze and make grounded decisions than it does for the survival brain to activate the nervous system into a threat response. This is by design. This is wisdom of your body. So our big reactions are the result of a decision being made for us by our survival brain. Big hypo or hyper arousal reactions are always unconscious. They are never intentional. They always happen faster than we can think about them. And this is the wisdom of our bodies protecting us. Also, we often hurt self and others when we're in this big reactive place. So, do we just react and apologize later? If we don't have conscious control over our reactions, what are we supposed to do? There are always going to be situations where big reactions are unavoidable. And you don't want to avoid an unconscious survival response if it's actually what's going to save your life, right? Like the acting and survival in those milliseconds can be life-saving sometimes. Sometimes not. Sometimes it just hurts other people or it hurts yourself. But those aren't the times I'm talking about. I am talking about being so in tune and connected to your body that you are able to notice when you're dysregulated and before you drift into hyper or hypoarousal. And you won't do this perfectly 100% of the time, and that's okay too. So I want you to think back to a time when you had a big anger reaction. Big. Maybe you screamed at someone, maybe you hit someone. Maybe you don't remember because the reaction was so big that you weren't totally present. Play that movie in your head. Recall the memory, play the movie in your head. Study yourself in that movie. Start from the beginning, maybe even start from before it started happening, and just play that movie of that time that you had that big anger reaction. Was there a point when you could feel the anger shift more into aggression or rage? Did it start out as irritability and frustration? And because you didn't slow down and honor those feelings, then it just escalated into being out of control rage? What did that feel like? Was it a sudden rush of heat to your face? Did your hands ball up in fists? Did you have an uncontrollable urge to belittle someone, to cuss someone out, to call them names, to be condescending and hurtful? Now think back to a time when you had a big collapse reaction, if you can think of one. Play that movie in your head. Was there a point when you felt a little bit of shame, but it got bigger and it got out of control? Was your body so heavy that you couldn't move or that you couldn't speak? Did you all of a sudden get like so tired it was like going to knock you out if you didn't go lay down right then? No matter what happened, when you're outside your window of tolerance, you can probably remember some cues that your body was in major distress. And if you can't, that's okay. You probably didn't have it within yourself to be aware of what was happening in your body in those moments. But now you can try to be aware and you can try to notice when dysregulation starts to become hyper or hypoarousal for you. So the main way to stay aware of what's going on in your body so that you know your line between dysregulation and hypo or hyperarousal is embodiment, being in your body. So when you are so in your body that you are aware of the little shifts and feelings and sensations, you can learn and recognize in real time what your signs of distress are that tell you that you're getting close to that edge of your window of tolerance. This is why it's so important to be in your body when you're interacting with someone, when you're having a conflict with someone, when you're parenting, so that you can stay in touch with when it's becoming too much for you. Staying in your body during a conflict, an emergency, an uncomfortable situation or feeling definitely takes practice. One thing I recommend to my clients as a first step toward embodiment during discomfort is to create some sort of touch point with their body. So these are embodiment touch points. Pretend you're in a conflict with your partner or with someone, your friend. You can place a hand or hands on your thighs during that conflict, and you can stay present with the sensation of your hands on your thighs and also be present with what this person is saying. Remember from the very first workshop, I had you close your eyes. I had you be aware of your right hand. And then I also had you be aware of the thoughts and the voice in your head, and you were able to be aware of both at the same time. So you can be aware of your hands resting on your thighs and also be present with whatever you're saying or with whatever the other person is saying. Another way to create an embodiment touch point is as you are in conflict or in an uncomfortable situation or whatever, is to do a body scan and notice where you're holding tension. So if you're holding it in your jaw, if you're holding it in your pelvic floor, maybe you're bracing, maybe you're sucking in your stomach. See if you can find those places as you're in this moment of discomfort and release them. Okay, that's a way of staying in your body. Also, if you're in a conflict or uncomfortable situation, you can stay in touch with your body by noticing your breath when the other person's communicating. Notice if your breath is shallow and irregular and slow it down and deepen it. You are capable of doing these things and still being present during a conversation or conflict or whatever. So here are some potential signs of distress. This may look different for you, but just generally, if your hands go in fists, if your eyes become kind of frozen, if you get fidgety, if there's a loss of focus, you might be dissociating. If you feel a rush of heat or flushing, if you're suddenly very, very angry, very anxious, if you're having a panic attack, if you're starting to blame other people, if you get a sudden headache or sudden other symptom, these can be signs that you're drifting from dysregulation into hypo or hyper arousal. This is also why whenever we were talking about triggers in the untriggered workshop, that I talked about slowing down and really noticing what do you feel in your body when you're triggered? And do you feel differently depending on the trigger? So that you can get really, really familiar with these things. And that's going to require slowing everything way, way down so that you can observe yourself. It is your responsibility to know when you are outside your window of tolerance. No one else can know this for you. So you can study yourself and become familiar with your own signs of distress. And when you are familiar with your signs of distress, you then have a responsibility, not only to yourself, but to other people, to go take care of yourself so that you don't end up throwing your hot potato of anger or anxiety or whatever on those other people. So now let's talk about finally widening your window of tolerance. So the way that we build capacity, resiliency, and flexibility in the nervous system is the exact same way we build muscle strength. We stress out the muscle by lifting something slightly heavier than we're used to. So if 20 pounds is easy for 8 reps, maybe you add stress by doing 20 pounds for 12 reps. Or maybe you add 10 pounds, but then do fewer reps. Whether you're adding more weight or more reps, you're adding stress. Yes? Then you rest the muscle, you allow it to recover. That's how you strengthen muscle. You don't walk into the gym and deadlift 350 pounds if you haven't trained for that. You would hurt yourself and it would probably be impossible. Your nervous system may not be able to face your big triggers right now because those triggers are like the 350 pounds that you can't deadlift without hurting yourself. Okay, so it's okay to start with small, uncomfortable things versus starting with the big things. This is why finding our edge of our window is so important. We stress the nervous system out intentionally to the edge, and then we come back to safety. And we consistently repeat this stress, safety cycle to build resiliency, flexibility, and capacity in our nervous systems. Creating more resiliency, flexibility, and capacity does not happen if you're always in safety, just like muscle is not built by lifting nothing. You don't build any muscle at all if you don't go to the gym and pick up a weight. You don't build any capacity, resiliency, or flexibility if you never experience stress. So here is kind of my diagram for widening your window of tolerance. So starting with safety, okay? If you are actually safe, you can do this when you're not stressed out or triggered. Like you can do this with a cold plunge, for example. Okay. And I don't recommend cold plunges for everyone. If you're in a state of burnout or chronic fatigue or a chronic freeze state or something like that, please don't do cold plunges. They're not going to be good for your nervous system, but take cold plunges as an example. Okay. Before you get into that water, you are in a state of safety. And then you make a choice. You consent to going into the cold water. This is intentionally exposing you to stress, to discomfort. Cold water is a stressor to the body. Then you titrate your exposure to that cold water. So maybe at first you can only stay in there for 10 seconds and that's it. And then you get out and you come back to safety. And then the next time you're like, okay, I stayed in there for 10 seconds. Now I want to try to see if I can get to 20. So you choose to go into that cold water. You intentionally expose yourself to that stressor. You now titrate the amount of time that you expose yourself to that stressor before you get out and you return to safety. The same thing can be done with stressors in life and the nervous system. Even if you are in a conflict with someone, you can remind yourself through those embodiment touch points, I am safe. I am choosing to allow this conflict to be an intentional exposure to stress so that I can titrate my ability to hold stress, and then I will return to safety afterwards. So sovereign safety. This is what sovereign safety means. I am my own authority. I trust myself. I decide what is best for me. I am allowed to take as much time as I need. I commit to the process. I establish safety in my body by practicing, and I choose this. That's sovereignty. Choice and consent means I know what I'm choosing and why. I understand the potential risks and benefits of this choice. I have made an informed decision to expose myself to this intentional stressor for the purposes of increasing my stress tolerance and widening my window of tolerance. I take full responsibility for myself and I consent to this intentional stressor. I'm going to give you some examples of intentional stressors here in a second. Intentional exposure means I'm doing this for the purpose of increasing my stress tolerance and widening my window. I am choosing this intentional stressor. I use my agency to decide when I begin and when I end this practice. And the three intentional stressors that I will give you for this class, if you want to practice outside of conflict all by yourself, are cold exposure, breath work, and an acupressure mat. If you don't know what an acupressure mat is, it is this. David can put a link in the chat for you. It has these like really pokey things on it, and you lay on it. It's like pretty uncomfortable. But I like to use this as an intentional stressor. It's a stressor for pain, but it also has really good benefits too. But it's also stressful. Okay. And then titration means I'm slowly and gently increasing my exposure to this stressor. I commit to not intentionally blowing myself out of my window of tolerance because that's not kind. I trust that I will be okay even if I do blow myself out of my window of tolerance. And I understand that consistent exposure to small stressors over time is preferable to trying to navigate a stressor I'm not yet ready for. So, three intentional stressors. When I say intentional stressors, of course you can use a conflict. Of course you can use, going out into a public place and socializing if social anxiety is something that you deal with. Like you are allowed to choose to use anything, any situation, any relationship as a source of intentional stress. But if you don't want to do it in real time when you're like out in public with social anxiety, or you don't want to do it in real time while you're navigating a conflict with someone, that's why I'm giving you these examples because you can do these all by yourself. So, cold exposure or cold plunges, breath work with breath holds, and an acupressure mat. Not all at the same time. Goodness, just choose one. The common theme with each of these stressors is that they give you opportunities to relax around discomfort and surrender to what's happening in your body, mind, spirit. So you can experience stress and discomfort and realize, hey, this isn't fun, but I'm okay. Okay. I first started doing this with cold plunges back in 2020. And I can tell you without a doubt that my ability to tolerate the stress of cold water translated to an ability to tolerate more stress outside of the cold water. Like it really, really did. So you might be surprised to discover that with consistent practice, you begin to love and even crave these intentional stressors, which is what happened for me with cold plunges and also what happened for me with the acupressure mat. The first couple of minutes, really fucking uncomfortable. But if you can relax around that discomfort, it kind of melts into a really pleasing sensation that makes you kind of sleepy and heavy, and it feels really good. But the first couple minutes are what's uncomfortable. So here's me laying on an acupressure mat. The stressor here is pain. It is best to use it with no shirt on, but obviously for this workshop, I did the picture with shirt on. And the first couple of minutes are the hardest, but they provide a wonderful opportunity to relax around pain. So please don't use an acupressure mat if you have any kind of skin inflammation, like a sunburn, back acne, eczema, or psoriasis, if you have unregulated high blood pressure, if you have thin skin due to something like Ehlers-Danlos or diabetes, if you have a blood coagulation issue, an open wound on your back, or a fever or acute illness, do not use an acupressure mat if you are experiencing those things. The next one is cold plunges. The stressor is cold. It's the most effective for the physical benefits at 60 degrees Fahrenheit or less. The colder the water, the more uncomfortable it is. So I definitely recommend that you titrate. I also do not recommend cold plunges if you are in a chronic shutdown or freeze state, if you are in a state of burnout, if you are in chronic fatigue, anything like that, please don't do cold plunges. They will probably do more harm than good. You may also want to look into information about doing cold plunges at certain times of your cycle. I've seen a lot of people who don't recommend cold plunges during the luteal phase of the cycle, but they do recommend during the follicular phase. I personally did cold plunges throughout my cycle and they always felt amazing for me. I don't plan on doing any cold plunges this summer, maybe towards the end of the summer, because I do still feel like I'm recovering from that burnout and coming out of it. And I don't want to add any more stress while I'm recovering from that. So cold plunges are an easy opportunity to practice complete presence and awareness. It's a great sovereignty practice. Beyond the physical benefits, beyond the reduced inflammation, beyond the ability to increase your stress tolerance. Cold plunges for me were really healing when it came to using my agency to get out of uncomfortable situations and using my agency to challenge myself to stay in uncomfortable situations. And I think that it was a really profound thing because if you think about it, when we were little kids and we were experiencing trauma, we didn't have a choice over when we got to leave. Like we were just there, right? We needed our parents for survival. So we didn't get to just like get up and walk out. And a lot of us learned helplessness and victimhood through that. And so that has carried into our adult lives where we have places in our lives where we can make choices and we can use our agency, but we don't. And so cold plunges are a really great way of being like, you know what? I am choosing to expose myself to this stress. And the second I don't want to be in this anymore, I use my agency to get out. And I think it's a really, really wonderful repatterning of some of our learned helplessness and victimhood that a lot of us experience. Cold plunges are also a great way to override your nervous system's survival response. What I mean by that is that extremely cold water that's 60 degrees or less, to your body is like a huge stressor because the body is like, I could literally go into hypothermia and die in like 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever. And so the natural urge when you get in really cold water is to gasp, and you can train yourself through your breath to get in the water, not gasp, and then use your breath to override the survival response so that you're not actually in a fight flight state. You're actually in this stressful situation, but you feel totally calm. So here are some tips for using cold plunges. If you choose, as I said, your nervous system instinct to cold temperatures is to gasp. So if you hold your breath going into the water, then you only have the option to exhale once you get in rather than inhale, which is a gasp. Oops. Oh, shit. Well, damn, guys, hold on. We went like way far. I don't know what button I hit. Sorry about that. Okay, there. We're back. Also, I recommend practicing muscle relaxation So when we are perceived with something that the nervous system perceives as threatening, and we go into a fight-flight response, we know that sympathetic activation means muscles tense. So the muscles will tense in cold water unless you override that nervous system response by noticing where there's muscle constriction and intentionally releasing it. So I often joke whenever I'm doing a cold plunge that if I can be in 50 degree water or 45 degree water and relax my pelvic floor to the point that I can pee in the water, then I've done a really good job of relaxing my muscles in this cold water. And I have done that before, and I cold plunge in Lake Superior, and it's totally okay to pee in the lake. I would not do that in like a cold plunge tank or a cold pool or something like that, but I will pee in the lake. And then I repeated a mantra. If you are actually feeling okay, please don't lie to yourself if you're not feeling okay. But if you are breathing and you're relaxing your muscles, then you are purposefully putting your nervous system into a calm state. That is the perfect state for mantras when you're in a calm state, because your nervous system can actually believe what it is that you're saying, versus if you're panicking, but you're like, I'm so comfortable being uncomfortable. Your nervous system does not believe that. Like, please don't lie to yourself. Do not do cold plunges if you have unregulated low blood pressure, impaired circulation, Raynaud's, cold urticaria, other hypersensitivities to cold, if you're using any kinds of drug or alcohol, or if you have epilepsy. And then I would also add to this, if you're in any kind of like chronic fatigue, burnout, chronic freeze state, anything like that, that is not a great time for you to do cold plunges. You could use a sauna. If you wanted to titrate your exposure to heat and use heat as a stressor, you could do a sauna, or you could do the acupressure mat, or you could do the breath work that I'm going to share about next. Also, if you do plan on doing cold plunges, please go with a friend until you're comfortable going by yourself. If you're plunging in a wild body of water, I highly recommend wearing water shoes. Let me tell you, coming out of a cold body of water that's all rocks when your feet are like numb and cold is very, very painful. So water shoes make that a lot easier. Don't take a hot bath or a hot shower to warm yourself up. Let your body warm up naturally by laying in the sun or by putting on layers of clothes or doing movements like squats or jumping jacks. That's a much better way to warm up than just sticking yourself in hot water. Get out of the water before you start shivering, and don't drink alcohol before cold exposure. Breath work. How many of you have watched the thawing the freeze response workshop that was included when you bought Feel Without Fear, or you've taken thawing the freeze response? Okay, this is the same breath work that I use in thawing the freeze response. This is it. It can be used as an intentional stressor. So the stressor is breath and sensation. This is also a great way to mobilize a frozen or collapsed nervous system. I like the Wim Hof breathing method, which is forced hyperventilation with breath holds. So you can get a full tutorial in the thawing the freeze response workshop, which all of you should have access to. When you're doing this type of breath hold, you will feel some sensations that you might feel are scary or uncomfortable. You might feel tingling in your hands, your arms, your face, or your feet. You will likely feel lightheaded or dizzy. That's really normal. It doesn't always happen, but it often happens. And when you're doing the breath holding part, you will be able to hold your breath for longer than you think is possible because of how much you're oxygenating your blood by doing the quick breathing. Wim Hof says breathing is the easiest and most instrumental part of the autonomic nervous system to control and navigate. In fact, the way you breathe strongly affects the chemical and physiological activities in your body. So to do this breath work, you're going to want to sit or lie down. Do not do this in a car. Do not do this when you're out and about, like you're going to want to be sitting or lying down to be safe. Take 30 or 40 deep breaths with your eyes closed and all of your focus on your breath. So you're going to inhale through the nose and exhale through the mouth. So after the last exhalation, inhale one more time, exhale completely, and stop breathing. And then hold that until you feel the natural urge to take a breath. Take a big full breath to fill your chest, hold for 15 seconds, and then resume normal breathing. This is the fast version of it. The one from thawing the freeze response is more of the full version of it, and it takes about 3 to 4 minutes. You can find a video tutorial for how to do this type of breath work here, or again, you could watch thawing the freeze response. When you do the Wim Hof method, the rapid breathing simulates the body's natural stress response and arouses your sympathetic nervous system. Think of how you would breathe if you were running from a predator or if you had just got a massive fright. It would be similar to, right? That is the Wim Hof breathing method. It's forced hyperventilation. There's nothing inherently wrong with manufacturing a stress response through breath work. One of the strengths of the Wim Hof method, when done correctly, is it builds resilience to stress. So when you're in a real stressful situation, like freezing cold water, for example, you're better equipped to deal with it. Studies are finding it may also have other valuable health benefits. Do not do this type of breath work if you are already in a highly stressed out sympathetic nervous system state. If your nervous system doesn't naturally downregulate, or you don't have the skills to downregulate, or if feeling dizzy, tingling, or lightheadedness will trigger anxiety or panic attacks or health anxiety, try the cold plunges, try the acupressure mat, try a sauna, try something else. Don't do this breath work. If this breathing method causes a fight flight activation that doesn't resolve on its own within a few minutes, you can downregulate your nervous system with another type of breathing, which is 1 to 2 breath work. Meaning, if you inhale for 5 seconds, you exhale for 10 seconds. If you inhale for 4 seconds, you exhale for 8 seconds. So the inhale exhale ratio is 1 to 2. So here's how you do that. You would lie on the ground or on a bed. You would soften your belly, relax your muscles, close your eyes, breathe in through your nose for 4 seconds, exhale out your nose for 8, or inhale for 3, exhale for 6, inhale for 5, exhale for 10, and do that for about 10 minutes. That should naturally shift your nervous system down if you get a little bit too activated. With each of these intentional stressors, you will find that consistent practice and returning to safety during the exercise translates to being able to tolerate more stress when you're not doing the exercise. And of course, your own feelings and sensations can be your intentional stressors if you choose. So if you have an uncomfortable sensation in your body, use that as your stressor. Be present with it, feel it, notice any ego stories about it. And over time, your ability to be present with and feel your own discomfort will grow too. And you can go back to that process of, okay, I'm having a feeling, but I'm safe. And I feel it, you know, it's a burning sensation in my solar plexus, for example. Okay, I'm safe. I'm choosing to feel this sensation. I'm using this as an intentional stressor to widen my window of tolerance to this sensation. The last time I felt this, I was only able to feel it for a minute or two, and then I got really overwhelmed. So this time I'd like to see if I can feel it for longer. And then whenever you're ready, you return to safety, whether that's by distracting yourself and doing something else, using a nervous system tool, doing some breath work, some tapping, whatever it is, you come back to that safe place. So you can do the same thing with your own sensations. All right, we have made it to the end of our workshop. Let's take another break. I don't want to do quite 8 minutes. That seems like a long break. Let's come back at 58 after the hour. So for me, it will be 6:58.